And that's what we talked about last week. And here are the there are seven things here that demonstrate the power that God worked through Samson. In 14:5, the first thing, he's on the road to Timnah, and a lion attacks him, and the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and he's able to kill the lion with his bare hands and very easily. Then in chapter 14, after his wedding, he basically makes a bet with the Philistines that, "I'm going to give you a riddle. I bet you can't answer it. If you figure out the answer, then I'll give you 30 pairs of clothing." Well, he was really setting up the Philistines, and when they cheated, he ends up going and killing 30 guys and taking their clothes and giving it to the men he lost the bet to, and gets angry and just leaves his wife there. And when he goes back to her to get his wife, his father-in-law gave his wife to another man. So he gets angry and burns the fields of the Philistines. And then in 15, 7, and 8, it talks about him striking them hip and thigh, which is just a euphemism way of saying he slaughtered them with a great slaughter. And then we see that he goes and hides out in a cave, and I believe it's the men of Judah came and said, 3,000 men came to get him, and he said, "Promise you won't hurt me." So they did, and he allowed himself to get bound up with new ropes, and they delivered him to the Philistines. And once that happened, he just was able to snap the ropes off his hands and go ahead and kill the Philistines in that place. The place was called Lehi, and Jawbone is the name, and they changed its name. Anyway, he takes a jawbone and kills 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. And then after this great battle, he's thirsty, and he's been fighting all day and not had a drink, and he feels like he's going to die because of his thirst. So the Lord provides water for him. But as we look at this part of Samson's life, what you see is the power of the Lord coming on him. Now, this gives a snapshot of the powerful works that he did, but there's another thing at the end of chapter 15. Maybe it's, let's just go ahead and turn there. The end of chapter 15, verse 20, it says, "And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years." So we get this snapshot of Samson, and really two pictures, but this sums up the career of Samson. Here are some mighty works that he's done. Obviously, it's the Spirit of the Lord coming upon him, and that's what makes him great. You see his birth, where he was dedicated to God since before conception even. And now here he is, he judges Israel for 20 years. And that's one half of it. And as you read through this and kind of think about some of the things he says, he talks about vengeance a lot. He's like, "Avenge me for my eyes, avenge me for this," so he's always going for vengeance. And it sounds like when he says that, the way you think is, oh, the only thing he cares about is himself and he's going to get even with anyone who slights him. But I think we have to weigh that against the idea of him being a judge in Israel, and part of a judge's job is vengeance. Vengeance, if you just want to give it a real simple definition, is as paying back, giving back whatever is due, so to speak. And so the reason why God is vengeance as the Lord is it, from a man's perspective, right? If someone, I heard an example that Lowell Williams used, so this is sort of his illustration. I'm just hijacking it. But what he was saying is there was a man and a real estate deal went bad, and this man was in an ice cream shop, and he wasn't involved in it, but he maybe was involved with the company. But this other guy in the ice cream shop, he orders the ice cream cone, and the guy walks up to him and says, "I hope you like ice cream," and shoves his ice cream in his face. And then he walks away, And so you have this idea of taking vengeance, and the problem is if someone does something wrong to me, and I try to do vengeance, I'm going to probably do too much. I'm going to give them more than they deserve. And if I say, okay, well, I'm not going to do it, then I'm going to have Al over here. He's going to take vengeance for me. Well, he probably wouldn't do enough, because it's just maybe he's a little bit more indifferent to whether or not I have ice cream shoved in my face. And so Al's just not going to do enough. And that's why we talk about the vengeance of God is perfect. he pays back exactly what is due. And as we see Samson here, he's a judge of God, and so the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and so he has that judgment aspect in his life. And so we see him avenging things, but also that is part of a role as a judge, is to be able to give out sentences and that sort of thing. I just think it's something to, you get a snapshot of Samson, and it doesn't, and he was brash and he was proud, but he was also a judge of God, and something that'll come up later. But if you look in Hebrews 11, the writer says, I don't have enough time to talk about it. And he names off all these judges, and Samson and Gideon and Jephthah are amongst the faithful mentioned in the book of Hebrews. And so we don't get the full picture of Samson, but he was a judge for 20 years, and he delivered, he was raised up. And what God said is he's going to deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. And that's exactly what you see him doing here. However, he did have a sinful side to him. And so this is, there's a contrast I want to draw. And as we look at this, in our own spiritual walk, there's a really close relationship to the story of Samson here and our own story. The first part, the overview is going to talk about all these great feats that happen, right? All these different ways that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson and helped him do something that he couldn't have done by himself. And so that's impressive, but our walk with God is exactly the same way. You know, if you think about our victory over sinfulness, our ability to have forgiveness, all these things that our ability to go out and spread the word. Jesus says, with man it's impossible, with God all things are possible. And so we have this ability to accomplish more than we would be able to apart from God. And so that's one part of our life. But then there's this other part that we need to be aware of. And so let's go and talk about Samson's death, and let's go ahead and go to Judges chapter 16. The first few verses talk about, there's two episodes here. The first one starts in Judges chapter 16. Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. So here he is. Gaza was a key Philistine city, so he went over to his enemy's city, and he goes and visits a prostitute. So you see, obviously, there was some spiritual lacking in Samson. He was not a completely righteous man. But there's something that happens here. He goes there, so his enemies hear about it, so they want to ambush him, and the gates are closed, and they think, okay, Samson's locked inside the city, we can't get in, he can't get out. So whoever was placed as a guard was not a really good guard, because obviously he didn't wake up when he was watching the gate, even though Samson pulled him out of the ground and carried him off. So he's in Gaza, and he leaves around midnight. He goes to the gates of the city, he pulls him up, slings him on his shoulder, and it says he carried him to a hill that was out towards Hebron. From what I read, I looked at a map and looked at the legend on the map, and it looked like it would have been 30 miles, but as I was reading a commentator who had actually been to the area, he said it was probably closer to 9 miles, so there's some discrepancy there, but I'll take the smaller number, because it's still impressive. Is he pulled up the gates of the city, carried him 9 miles to the top of this hill. And so you see, if you look at a map of Gaza, there's a plain and then a hill over there. And so he carried it off there and leaves the gates of the city there. The people who were laying in ambush, they didn't catch him. But there's something here I think is interesting, is he did this mighty feat, and yet it doesn't, in most times when something like this happened, it said the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he does this thing. Well, in this case, it doesn't mention that, but it mentions that he was there for really wicked purposes, and then he exercises his strength. And so that's the first thing we see. But that's the first thing we see about it. Yeah, and when it talks about carrying the gates, it doesn't say the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. But really what this whole chapter is about is Samson not recognizing God. And we'll see that as we come on. So the first one is Samson's enemies were seeking to destroy him. But the point I want to make out of this is Samson wasn't strong. He was strengthened by God. And so there's a difference as we talk about that. And this is an important point we need to understand. You know, the problem Samson had is he was able to do these great things. He was able to pull up gates. And I mean, imagine, now I'll give you sort of the idea here. Hebron was where the sons of Anak lived. So there would have been the giants that Caleb went and fought against. So there were giants in this area. So as I was thinking about, well, what size is the gate? Well, was it 6 feet wide? Well, I don't know if a cart and a horse would be able to get through 6 feet. And so maybe it was 10 feet wide or wider. But I was trying to just imagine sort of a realistic size. So let's say 8 feet wide. And if Goliath was 9 feet tall, would he have to duck to go under the gates? Or how does that work? So I imagine probably at least 10 feet so there's enough clearance for the big guys to go through. And so you have this 8 by 10, a gate that's strong enough to withstand a frontal assault. So you imagine, you know, a bunch of guys with a log slamming the door. So it's not going to be like our doors where a couple inches thick. It's probably made from, you know, logs. And then there's this big crossbeam that locks it down so to secure it. And so it was a heavy built thing. And yet here's Samson, he pulls it up out of the ground, he carries it off, but he sort of uses it to assist himself in escape, even though what he's doing is sinful. And what he starts believing is, it's me. I'm the one with the strength. I have this ability to do things that other people don't. And he starts acting arrogant and proud about it. And that's really what I think this really demonstrates, is the arrogance of Samson. But, and so here's a picture of, okay, do I have another map on here or not? No, I don't have another map on here. So I was trying to find a map of Gaza and Hebron. I couldn't get one that you could actually see the right perspective. But this will give you at least a brief idea. Gaza is out here more, probably more like in this part of the map, towards the, near the ocean. And Hebron would be sort of right in here. But just to give you an idea of perspective. But then it says he went to the valley of Sorek. And there he found a woman that he fell in love with named Delilah. And on the map what you'll see is the valley of Zorek is kind of right in between Zora and Beth Shemesh. If I can't read it on my screen, you guys probably can't read it either way. But anyway, here's Zora, Beth Shemesh, and this is the valley of Zorek. But the important thing about that is that's where Samson grew up. So he's back in his hometown, and he meets a girl named Delilah. And Delilah, then there's deception, right? There's deception going on, and I put the deception of, because Delilah deceives Samson and Samson deceives Delilah, so really a dysfunctional relationship just from the offset of that. But he gives her, there's a few tasks that, you know, she wants to find out, you know, if you love me, if we're close, you need to share your secrets with me. So that's Delilah. Well, first thing that happens is the Philistines come to her and all these kings say, we'll pay you 1,100 silver pieces each if you deceive him and find out what weakens him. And so she goes to Samson and wants to find out, well, if you love me, you'll tell me what weakens you. And so Samson seems to be somewhat of a jokester based on his rhyming and his riddles and all that other things, you know. But so she's like, well, how do I bind you? How do I make you weak? And he's like, well, tie me up with 7 fresh bowstrings. So she turns out he's wakes up with 7 fresh bowstrings, binding him up. And she says, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And he snaps them off. So that doesn't work. And then she's like, why are you lying to me, Samson? You need to tell me, what is it that makes you weak? I need to know. I just want to share this secret with you. Know, however she frames it. And so he's like, okay, all right. I was just messing with you. Tie me up with some fresh ropes that I've never used for anything else, and that's what's going to make me weak. So she does it. Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He snaps his hands free again. You know, maybe he's having a good laugh at this one. You know, she's upset, but he's kind of fooling around, joking with this. And so, nope, that's not going to work. And so he tells her, okay, well, give me a weave. You know, maybe not the kind of weave we think of, but weave my hair into a garment of some sort. And I was thinking about, is he suspicious, or is he just kind of being jovial with it, or what's the thought process, and maybe what time frame is going on here? Anyway, it's sometimes you don't get the whole picture. You just get this happened and this happened and this happened. But I wonder what circumstances, because if he was suspect, it just seems a little bit strange that he actually tells her the truth. And maybe, so anyway, so he got a weave. Again, he wakes up, pulls his hair out of the weave, and okay, we're not, no Philistines again. So finally, and let's go ahead and take a look in chapter 16. And verse 13. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound." And he said to her, okay, so keep going down. Oh, verse 15. And she said to him, "How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these three times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies." And she pressed him hard with her words day after day, and urged him, and his soul was vexed to death. This is just kind of one of those funny statements in the Bible. She asked him and asked him, and, "You don't love me. If you loved me, you would tell me." And I can imagine, you know, just all the times that this got brought up. And finally, Samson just got annoyed, irritated with her. And maybe he wanted to rekindle the relationship. Maybe that was it. But whatever it was really weighing on him. And so finally he says, "I've never had my hair cut. God told my parents that as long as he's a Nazirite, then he's going to have strength." But I was thinking about this, and, you know, he's seen what's happened every time he told her that. And the question I have in my mind is, did he think really that this was going to weaken him, or what was it? Because on one hand, you know, she did everything he said, and so it seems like you would know. But and maybe he had got to thinking that he was strong, and God just made him a little stronger. You know, I don't know what it is, but whatever it was. He was in a situation where he was in a covenant relationship with God, if you want to think of it that way. See, the Lord made a covenant: as long as he's a Nazirite, I'm going to bless him and I'm going to let him be the deliverer. Well, cutting the hair was the termination of that particular vow that Samson lived under. And what you see is, you know, when people go out of the covenant relationship, break the promise, that's when God removed his power. And that's what we see here is Samson had his head shaved, and she said, "The Philistines are upon you," and he thought he was just going to get up and do what he always did. And that tells me, I don't know what that tells us, but it seems like that tells us something. It says, verse 20, it says, "And she said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' And he awoke from his sleep and said, 'I will go out as at other times and shake myself free.' But he did not know that the Lord had left him." Now, I had a haircut today. Now, not intentionally, but I can feel the difference. You know, my head feels a little bit colder than it did earlier today, lighter. And I've had many haircuts in my life. You don't wake up from having your head shaved, having never had a haircut, and not realizing it. So even though Samson told her that, he woke up, his hair was gone, and he thought he was still going to be able to go and do what he did before. So that tells you something about his mindset. He had attributed the strength to himself to some degree, and maybe to a large degree. But what it says here is that he didn't know that the Spirit of God had left him. So he thought he was still strong, and he wasn't. So he had his hair cut. The Lord left him. And there's a few things that happened here. And this is very pertinent to us, because he had his eyes gouged out. He was made blind, and then he was enslaved. And it's important for us to recognize what happened to Samson, because this happens to us. Is a lot of times, I think, as we go through our Christian walk, we start getting to the point where we might tell ourselves, "It's because of what I'm doing that I'm having success. It's because of what I'm doing that I'm going to have this salvation or eternal life. And maybe we start living our lives according to a guideline of rules. We start saying, okay, I've done this, I haven't done these things. What I do is the reason why I'm going to be saved. I follow the rules. I go to church every service. And we start taking credit or part of the credit for what God is doing. And we can see that is it's a subtle thing. You know, we may not outright, we recognize it's God. But then at the same time, we might start saying, well, but it's because I've done all these things. And start attributing credit to ourselves and stop honoring God. And that's really what happened with Samson is he stopped honoring God. He stopped recognizing God and thanking God. Turn with me to Romans 1. Paul talks about this very similar circumstance. Romans 1 verse 20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And really, that's what happens to Samson to a large degree. Is it was obvious that the strength he had was from God. And yet, from his own perspective, it became less and less obvious until finally he blinded himself to the truth. He didn't acknowledge the truth. He didn't thank God for the wisdom he had, or for the power he had. In fact, he started abusing the power that was given to him, and so here he is in his arrogance. He allows his hair to get cut, and then God leaves him. You know, in his arrogance, he breaks the vow. God leaves him, and he's blinded. But that is sort of a physical play out of what was going on in his heart. And that's really the point I'm making, is sometimes our hearts are blinded and we don't recognize and give glory and honor to God and don't recognize how very weak we are without God. You know, one of the reasons we struggle with sin the way we do is because we want to say, I can solve this problem on my own. I can come up with the right solution. I can do it on my own. And we're not poor in spirit. That's what Jesus says. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Someone who realizes that without God, I am utterly lost and lacking and unable to accomplish anything spiritually. And so in a physical sense, that was Samson. As he started thinking that he could accomplish things without God, and he was wrong. So his eyes were gouged out, and he was brought to prison and made a slave who grinds wheat, which was pretty much the lowest form of slavery. And so he was in prison grinding the wheat, pushing a mill. And as he was in prison, his hair started growing. And the impression I get from reading this is now they're going to have a great celebration to Dagon. My impression is it's because of their victory over Samson. So they have this victory over Samson. They're going to celebrate. They're going to have a huge sacrifice to their god Dagon. And everybody's there. They have this huge party going on. And at some point in the party, they end up wanting to have Samson come up and entertain them. I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know if Samson had been beaten down to the point where maybe he knew, if I don't do what they say, I'm not going to get fed or whatever it is. But here's Samson. He gets brought out, and they're just mocking him. They're making a mockery of him, and it's something to think about. He was the great hero. He was the unconquerable foe, and now here he is being entertainment for a bunch of people who are drunk celebrating to their god Dagon. And so Samson, in the midst of all this, asked to be leaned on the pillars of the building. I believe I have some illustrations here. So here's a picture of this, and this is an excavation they found. They've actually found two of these where they found Philistine temples, and as you can see, right in the center of the building, there's these two pillars. Here's a better picture of it, but they're about 6 feet apart, so they're wide, like my reach is about 6 feet, so if Samson was just a bit bigger than me, he would be able to make the push. But it collaborates the story, which is just interesting. But now here's Samson in the middle of this structure, 3,000 people up on the top, on the roof story of it, a bunch of people on the inside, they're celebrating. And let's go ahead and read what Samson says, because he realizes what happens. Then Samson called to the Lord, "O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me this once. O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." And Samson grasped the two middle pillars and on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords, upon the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed during his life. So we'll stop there, but here's the thing. Is Samson, at the very end, what did he say? "Lord, you're the one who strengthens me. Strengthen me one more time." And because he finally got it, you know, he was, you know, on one part of his life, he's healthy and formidable, and yet he doesn't acknowledge God. And then he's captured and blinded and enslaved. But after he's captured and blinded and enslaved, he saw himself for what he was. And that's really the point. He saw himself as weak. He wasn't even able to go stand between the two pillars without a young child leading him by the hand. That's how weak he was. He wasn't able to do anything on his own because he was blinded, and he recognized that. So finally, here at the very end of Samson's life, he gets it, right? He gets it. It's God who strengthens us. And look at what happens at this last moment of his life, because now we have this huge 20-year history before this, and he's the great Savior of Israel, even though he has all these flaws. But at the end of his life, the last moment when he finally realizes and acknowledges who God is, his victory in his death was greater than anything he had done in his entire life. And that's something we need to pay, we also need to draw in on. You know, sometimes I think we might get that mindset where we're not poor in spirit, where we're proud and we go after our lusts and we attribute the strength that God gives us to ourselves and our own abilities. But it's only when we die to ourselves, when we see ourselves for what we really are, just weak and incapable and blind and slaves. If we saw ourselves in the light that Samson had to see himself in, then we would say the same prayer, Samson. Strengthen me just this once. Lord, you're the one where any strength I've ever had comes from. And if we acknowledge that, and we die to ourselves, and we realize it's always God who strengthens me, then we would have the strength to be able to accomplish the same great feat that Samson did, where we can do more at our death than we did in our life. And that's really the thing I want us to think about as we talk about Samson. You know, there's a really great parallel to our Christian walk, and there's something we need to recognize in him, is that it's only when we acknowledge who we really are and who God really is that we're going to have our greatest victory. And so as we move forward, let's go and just keep that in mind and maybe think about that this week and consider where do we stand with God and who is God and what does he do for us. Are there any thoughts or comments on that before we move on? If not, then let's go ahead and take a look at the last few chapters of Judges are, one guy put, I liked it, they're appendixes to the book. They're not the primary material, but they illustrate something about the era. And so we have two illustrations, and the appendix one I call righteousness, appendix two I call justice. And so we're gonna see both, this week we're gonna look at righteousness, and next week we'll look at justice. But I want to give a layout of where the children of Israel have gotten themselves. And I want to start back in Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy, where this particular reading takes place, they are on the east side of the Jordan River. They're preparing to go in. They are making a treaty, essentially, with God as one nation to a suzerain or a more powerful king. And they're making this agreement with him. And that's the book of Deuteronomy. But in this chapter, Moses is about to die. Joshua is going to become their leader. And so Joshua and Moses go to the tent of meeting. And in verse 21, and so God says a bunch of things, but in verse 21, he gives us some insight into the heart of the people. It says, "And when many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know that they are inclined to what they are inclined to do, even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give." And what God is saying is, before we even go into the land, as we're making this covenant together, the people are already deciding, which idol am I going to serve? So that's the heart of this people, is before they even go in, they're already being tempted to go out and worship idols in the land of promise. Now turn with me to Deuteronomy, or Judges chapter 2. And verses 10 through 15. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples and were around them, and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. So we see this this degradation as soon as Joshua dies. And that's really the context here. As soon as Joshua dies, the people turned to the Baals. A generation arose who didn't know God, and they just went off and did whatever they wanted to do, worshiped whatever God they wanted to do. In Judges 17, in 17:6 and 18:1, there's a statement made here that says, "And there was no king over the people, and each man did what was right in his own eyes." And the sort of the American way to describe this situation is extreme libertarianism. Where, okay, we're just going to get rid of all the laws, get rid of all the things, just let everyone do whatever they want to do. Why do we need a government? We're just going to get rid of it all. And so that's where they were at. There was no centralized government, and there was no king. So each man was responsible to uphold the law in his own family. And that's the situation here. There wasn't a king. Each man was expected to uphold the law in his own family. And God gave judges to help them along. So that's where they're at here when Micah does this. In Romans, so then the question is what good does a king do? And the contrast I would make is, as Christians, Christ is our king. And in Romans 3:23 through 26, what it says is, that each man is everyone. For everyone has sins and falls short of the glory of God, but Jesus Christ demonstrated righteousness for us. And so one of the benefits of a king is he's a demonstrator of righteousness. He shows how to be righteous, but also he rules over the people and enforces laws and does those types of things. And so there's different problems with a king, but there's some sort of form of law enforcement going on as well. And in Proverbs 14:12, this verse Mel and I both memorized when we were kids in Bible class, but it says, "The way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the end is the way of death." And that's really the situation here. Each man did what was right in his own eyes, But those ways were leading to death. And so this gives a, this section gives us a picture of the condition of Israel during the time of the judges and what caused them to go astray. So let's go ahead and take a look real quick. And I know we won't get far, but that'll be good because next week we'll be able to take these two stories together. But in verse 17, there was a man named Micah and a woman, Micah's mother, who turns up 1,100 pieces of silver have gone missing. And she, you know, she doesn't know what happened to them. And so finally Micah comes, she curses the money, you know, whoever gets this money, may he get sick and die and his family get sick and die. And so whatever kind of curse that she puts out there. And because of the curse that Micah heard, he fesses up and says, "Mom, I'm the one who took the money. I didn't want the curse to come upon you." And so then she responds by saying, "Okay, bless you, my son," you know, removing the curse. So that's where this story starts off, is Micah stealing from his own mother. And as we read through this, let's just take a quick look. You know, I'm not going to have time, but my question is going to be, maybe I'll leave this question with you as we go forward next week. Maybe I'll shoot out an email that reminds you. But how many of the Ten Commandments are broken in this first few verses that introduce the story of Micah? That's the question I want to ask for next week. Is that's your homework assignment, is read through there and try to identify how many of the Ten Commandments were violated in just this introduction without leaving his house. Essentially, without leaving his house, how many of the Ten Commandments did Micah break here? And that just gets the ball rolling with this section of scripture that gives you the feel for what was going on in Israel at that time. We'll go ahead and end there, and next week we'll pick up and it'll be our last study in Judges. So we'll go from 17 to the end of the chapter, and then the next quarter, I don't know exactly who's teaching on Wednesday night, but I'll know that next week and let you know. So let's go ahead and be dismissed.